remember, the Communications Decency Act is passed in a rush, right? Passed in a rush, really precipitated by that Time magazine article, which was describing a story, describing a report that had been thrown together by a Carnegie Mellon undergraduate. Okay, that was the source of the Communications Decency Act. I mean, it wasn't, the bill was there, but it wasn't really going anywhere until that story came out and all of this stuff got read on the floor of Congress. Not in the Senate version, but written into the law in committee after the House and Senate bills had been passed and they were trying to resolve the differences between them. This hastily written paragraph was added. No provider or user of an interactive computer service shall be treated as the publisher or speaker of any information provided by another information content provider. Okay, and speaker here in general, speaker is just in the sense of free speech. It's speaker means author, you know, for our or artist, or you know, it's anybody who's expressing something in any medium. So no provider or user of an interactive computer service, so anybody, that's Comcast, whatever, the Boston Globe, anybody who runs a website, insofar as they're allowing other people to post stuff, shall be treated as the publisher or speaker of any information provided by another information content provider. So the Boston Globe is responsible for what their writers write. Okay? But the Boston Globe has I guess I lost it. Okay. But anyway, the Boston Globe has no responsibility for all of those comments that other people provide. That's what this says. So here's section 230, which I asked you to read. Okay. This is this thing that was written in committee. It's the policy of the United States. Should I make that bigger?
That's right.
To promote the continued development of the internet and other interactive computer services. So this is meant to help the internet develop, preserve the vibrant and competitive free market, to encourage the development of technologies. You know, we're all in favor of, and here's the important one, to remove disincentives for the development and utilization of blocking and filtering technologies that empower parents to restrict their children's access to objectionable or other objectionable or inappropriate online material. So what are the disincentives to which this clause is referring? What disincentives had existed prior to Section 230 to the deployment of, you know, technologies that would enable parents to automatically filter out bad stuff that they didn't want their children to see? Why? What was the problem? What was the problem?
Was it the Prodigy decision?
Or? The problem. This was the problem. Right. This was the problem. The problem was that, you know, this was exactly what Prodigy was trying to do. Prodigy was on the side of good, right? Remember, Prodigy was trying to create a child-friendly space within cyberspace. So Congress wanted, in Section 230, to encourage companies to develop filtering technologies. That's what the point of this was. Okay, and they wanted to, you know, make sure that there would be, you know, bad guys would be prosecuted. And so there's this Good Samaritan clause, protection for Good Samaritan blocking. And that's where this clause is. No provider or user of an interactive computer service shall be treated as the publisher or speaker of any information provided by another information content provider. You're not, the CompuServe is not, I mean, I'm sorry, Prodigy is not the you know, the publisher. And no provider or user or interactive computer service, the Boston Globe, Prodigy, whatever, shall be held liable on account of any action voluntarily taken in good faith to restrict access to or availability of material that the provider or user considers to be obscene, lewd, lascivious, filthy, excessively violent, harassing, or otherwise objectionable, which is a big catch-all there, whether or not such material is constitutionally protected. Okay, so that's where CDA Section 230, the Good Samaritan clauses, came from. They were an attempt written into this legislation at the last minute to fix the problem that had been created by the Stratton-Oakmont decision. And they sound perfectly reasonable. They have some, you know, bizarre consequences. So before we look at this one, I mean, let's remember the one that, you know, I tell, you know, a couple of horrible stories, and, you know, which still the, you know, most dramatic one is the story of Ken Zarin, this poor guy in Seattle who, after the bombing of the federal building in Oklahoma, was the subject of a prank, someone posting stuff on AOL telling people to call Ken because he was selling funny t-shirts about this bombing in which a daycare center had been brought down and with lots of little children in it. And he received all these abusive telephone calls. And when he figured out how this happened, that it was because somebody had posted his telephone number on AOL, AOL just kind of shrugged its shoulders, because they were completely off the hook for what somebody else had published, even if they knew it was false, and even if it was making, you know, Ken's life miserable. AOL has no responsibility because they're not to be treated as the publisher of anything that anybody posts on AOL. So they, if they wanted to, out of the goodness of their heart, they could take that posting down. They would be under no risk that that person could sue them for, you know, censoring their free speech, but they also have no incentive to do anything. Okay? Or, you know, that's a horrible personal story about one individual. But consider this story. So let's review what happened here. Bloomberg runs a site that publishes news bulletins about businesses. This is getting to be a recurring theme of this class. Right? They employ a stringer, a small company, to give them tips to publish. A guy who worked for that company typed bankruptcy 2008 into Google News and got back a story about United Airlines having declared bankruptcy. This guy doesn't read the story. He passes it on to Bloomberg because he thinks it's important if United Airlines has declared bankruptcy. Bloomberg doesn't read the story and posts the headline, actually just the headline, not even the story, on its news site. People see it and start selling United Airlines stock. And over a period of just a few seconds, half a minute or a minute or something like that, United Airlines stock drops from 12 to nearly 3. They stop trading, try to figure out what's going on. They realize that it's because of this post. They figure out that the post on the Bloomberg site, Bloomberg figures out that the post on the Bloomberg site is actually the headline of a six-year-old story that through some unexplained circumstances, but nothing particularly nefarious, just kind of the mysteries of what Google gives you and what it doesn't give you, happened to have been returned by that stringer when he typed bankruptcy 2008. He happened to get back this story about United Airlines having declared bankruptcy in 2002. Okay. So this all eventually gets unraveled. You know, some people do very well by buying back in when they again resume trading. Some people bought back in down here and, you know, quadrupled their money in the same few seconds that other people, or in the subsequent few seconds to the time that other people had lost all that, you know, all that value. United Airlines winds up where it is. There are some big winners and some big losers as, you know, as a result of this. And so, but what's the moral for today's class? It's not about, you know, how fast the internet moves and how wonderful and, you know, how what a peculiar animal Google is. It's that nobody's liable. Okay? You know, if you sold at 3 when you suddenly realized that, you know, it was likely to go down to 0 because, okay, and you've lost, you know, your life savings in the process here. Hope no one in their right mind has all of their life savings in United Airlines stock, but, right? There's no one to blame. You can't sue Google because, you know, what does Google do? Google, you know, can't sue Google over which things turn up when you do a Google search. You'd think that you might be able to sue Bloomberg, but you can't sue Bloomberg because all Bloomberg did was repost on its website something that someone else had provided it. What if Bloomberg had actually printed it in a newsletter and put it in the mail? CDA doesn't apply there. This is a clause that only refers to interactive computer services. If Bloomberg had put that information in a good old-fashioned newsprint newsletter and put a stamp on it and sent it to you, and people had responded to it, it would be the publisher. That's what it is. That's a publisher is somebody who prints stuff on paper and, you know, sells it to people. But because it was up only on their website and not in their paper publication, which they probably also have, they're completely absolved from responsibility for the falsehood of the information on which people acted. Because they didn't, and also because, you know, it wasn't one of their journalists asserting it. They just said, you know, there's this story. I don't know exactly what the thing was, but I think this is it. It just said, there's this story from such and such a newspaper that says United Airlines was. Now, I don't know that this has been tested, but that's my, I mean, I, you know, the blog seemed to agree that CDA Section 230 gets Bloomberg completely off the hook on this. Yes?
But up on their website by one of their journalists.
By one of their journalists that said, you know, that said United Airlines has declared bankruptcy, you know, then I imagine they would have some liability.
Then they're a publisher, even though there's no paper involved at that point. That makes sense, I think.
Because this no publisher liability speaker only applies to information provided by another information content provider. It doesn't get you off the hook for information that you yourself provide. It's only that you're only absolved of liability in the case of stuff that other people put up. So on that Globe story, you know, if the Globe story about gay marriage, you know, said that Cardinal O'Connor is gay, okay, then Cardinal O'Connor can sue the Globe. But if the blogger, if somebody comments and says that, then the Globe has no liability at all.
Right. This one seems to have even more twists and turns, by the way.
Go ahead.
Because just from this little bit of reading, it looks like it was actually done by another group, Income Securities Advisors, that has a newsletter that they publish, so they may have some liability. But the date on the story, there was no date on the original Florida Sun Sentinel story, and Google, when they archived it, added the date they archived it, so it looked like it was a 2008 date. So we have bits everywhere with this one.
Yeah. I remembered it was a little more complicated.
It goes like around in circles and circles and circles on this.
But as far as I know, no one has sued anybody.
I don't think so.
Okay, so here's another one. We already talked about this one. This is the Siegenthaler. This is the Wikipedia entry on Siegenthaler. Now, Siegenthaler actually didn't try to sue Wikipedia. He wasn't going to try to collect any damages from anybody on this, but he wanted the world to know that you can't trust anything that's on Wikipedia. And actually, Wikipedia revised some of its editorial suggestions. I think we're going to talk more about Wikipedia next time. You know, as a result of this. But since Wikipedia is nothing but a lot of postings made by anonymous third parties, the Wikipedia Foundation, which is the legal entity that owns the Wikipedia site, is, absolved under Section 230 of all responsibility for the Siegenthaler hoax.